dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, I'm going to continue reading from Chapter 5, The World Under Control, from Charles Eisenstein's 2006 book, The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and the Convergence of Crises that is Birthing the Transition. This chapter has been dealing with the control of the human being, both individually and collectively. The justification for social control is based on an ideology about the nature of human nature, that we are essentially depraved, greedy, and violent, and that we need various institutions of control and indoctrination, both secular and religious, to overcome this allegedly bestial nature and humanize us. This ideology was embodied very well in a famous work of fiction from the 1950s, Lord of the Flies by William Golding, that allegedly demonstrates what happens when culture created by man fails. Using as an example a group of British upper-class schoolboys stuck on a deserted island, who become savage and murderous in the absence of the civilizing influence of adult society. According to the American Library Association, this once best-selling book, that has often been mandatory reading in school curricula, has become one of the most challenged in recent years, and with good reason. Eisenstein has not referred to this book. It is my encapsulation of Eisenstein's argument in this chapter that explores how our social institutions, based on the ideology of control, mold the human being to fulfill its prophecy of our innate badness. The brutal competitive nature given free rein by the boys in the novel, rather than being an unvarnished display of our bestial essence, reflects the very indoctrination of domination and class stratification that has been inculcated into these boys, partially by their schooling, in an elite institution designed to produce the future leaders of society. What we see in the behavior of the boys is not a rejection of civilization, but the ideological basis of our civilization stripped of its obscuring trappings. So let us return to the reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Continuing in Chapter 5 from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein, The World Under Control, Life and Death. From the standpoint of the separate self, the ultimate victory of the technological program would be to triumph over death itself. In one form or another, this goal drives all our efforts to dominate, accumulate, and control. It exists in diluted form in the pursuit of security. It is written into our ideology of competition and survival of the fittest. Yet despite propaganda to the contrary, millennia of intensifying control have done nothing to hold death at bay. The predominant causes of death have changed, but not its inevitability, and not nearly as much as we would like to think the human lifespan. As always, we humans are born, we live, and we die. Failing to overcome death, we seek instead to deny it by hiding it away and pretending it won't happen. In polite company, we deny it with euphemisms. In most children's stories of the last 50 years, we simply never mention it, in contrast to the fairy tales of yore. In our funerary practices, we deny death by applying cosmetics and embalming, and by preserving corpses for centuries in lead-lined coffins. We hide away our sick and dying in hospital intensive care units as we go through frantic medical rituals to preserve just a few more hours of life at whatever cost. We buy packaged food that obscures the fact that an animal or plant had to die. In our religion, we deny death through various conceptions of an afterlife. In our lives, we pursue goals and ambitions that simply would not make sense if we had integrated the fact of our eventual dying. And in our scientific fantasies, we imagine that someday we can transcend death through nanotechnology, genetic engineering, cyborg technology, or computers. So successful are we at hiding death that many people grow up never having seen a dead person. Surely an unprecedented phenomenon on planet Earth. Thanks to our pusillanimous storybooks, polite euphemisms, and hiding of corpses, from the perspective of the child, it is as if death did not exist at all, an impression strangely consistent with the ubiquitous violence of television cartoons, in which characters survive a 10-ton safe or a bomb falling on them with no permanent ill effects. It is also, again, strangely consistent with the graphic and deadly violence of adult television and movies, in which the killing of legions of bad guys is shorn of nearly everything that makes death, death. The deep reason why our culture finds it necessary to deny death is that death puts the lie to the agenda of our narrowly conceived selves. Contemplation and integrated awareness of death reveals the unreality or the conditional reality of the discrete and separate self. Because the self that we define as our bodies, our names, our knowledge, our possessions, our self-image, and our stories, Alan Watts's skin-encapsulated egos, did not exist before we were born and will cease to exist when we die, that self is unreal, impermanent. Along with it, the dualism of self and environment is unreal as well. It is no accident that every spiritual tradition that I know of has practices consisting of the contemplation of death. That's also why a close brush with death is so transforming. We stop worrying about the trivial concerns of life and walk in the knowledge, as one near-death survivor put it, that only love is real. When death exposes the impermanence and conditional reality of the self as we know it, all of the behaviors based on its aggrandizement no longer make sense. Society as we know it is based upon these behaviors. Hence, societies need to euphemize, hide, and deny death. Because it accompanies the denial of our true selves, our denial of death is equally a denial of life. And separation from death is separation from life. Death punctures the illusion of self as we conceive it, and on a psychological level rends the fabric of the modern world, hence the cultural necessity of denial. When will we cease denying death? Probably only when we no longer can, when it invades our lives so forcefully that the old illusions cannot stand. As the social, ecological, and physiological underpinnings of health accelerate their decay, this invasion is gathering in force and ubiquity. On the personal level, it will come as a realization that the lives we had been living simply do not make sense and cannot go on. On the collective level, this realization is precisely that of the unsustainability of modern society that the environmentalists keep telling us about. Just as a person has often to become very sick or experience a close brush with death in order to wake up to life, so it is also probably necessary for the same thing to happen on the planetary level before we as a species wake up to the fraudulence of our dualistic conception of ourselves as separate from nature. When our collective survival is imminently, dramatically, and undeniably in danger, and only then our present collective behaviors and relationships to the rest of life will cease to make sense. Cultures less enslaved to the myth of separateness feared death less, too, seeing it not as an ending but a return. Our fear of death is a product of the same linear thinking that underlies interest money and all the other expressions of the age of fire. It would not occur to someone immersed in the cyclic worldview that underlies the economy of the gift. By virtue of being born, we are all sojourners in the play of separation. But few before us have wandered in so deeply as to forget the wholeness from whence we came. Almost. We have not really forgotten and can never forget what we are. It remains as a stirring in the heart, enduring forever until the world under control, the world of the separate self, cannot hold. Our interbeingness, banished from waking experience, manifests as a longing, an empathy for other living beings and even inanimate objects. Characteristically, psychologists consider it a mild pathology to project human attributes onto inanimate objects. Even animals and plants we invest with a lesser degree of being than ourselves. Not thinking they, per Descartes, have less amness. Far from mental illness, I see these tugs of identification with the other to be glimpses of an underlying truth. It is only because they deny our presumed separateness that we dismiss them as irrational. Of course, according to the same premise, falling in love is irrational too. What reason is there to care for anyone else? Why should I strive for another's benefit? What's in it for me? Love and any form of compassion crumbles the walls of separation. However, we may explain it away according to some biological imperative. Anyone who has been in love knows there is more to it than a procreative urge or an unconscious bargain for mutual aid. The ecstasy and bliss that suffuses lovers in full flesh is an outcropping of the underlying joy inherent in our true state of union. Love, breaking down the barriers between me and thee, connects us to that state. It is our lifeline to sanity, to the wholeness of what we are. That is also a pretty good definition of Christ, an identity the early church fathers recognized in their more lucid moments. Love saves us from our limited ego selves, breaches the fortress of our separation, rescues us from the inevitable hell that our addiction to control creates. As many poets and mystics have perceived, love and death are intimately related. Both involve a dissolution of the ordinary boundaries of self. On the individual level, this dissolution is the felt realization. You and I are not really separate. On the collective level, it is a realization that human beings are not separate from nature. Another way to view the shift of consciousness that this book heralds is that we will fall back in love with the world. The collective realization of the unity of human and nature tells us what we do to the world, we do to ourselves, a concept I'll refer to as ecological karma. This goes beyond interconnectedness, or the pragmatic realization that we depend upon nature. The human-nature dualism implies that we can avoid the consequences of our depredations and manage their costs and benefits. We can choose this forest to clear-cut and that mountain to strip-mine, because according to our rational calculations, they are less important than other ones. They are not critical ecosystems. We don't really need them. Their value is conditional. We feel we can preserve some and destroy others, as long as we calculate the effects carefully enough, the costs and benefits. In contrast, the understanding of ecological karma tells us that we can never manage or avoid the effects of our actions, that any marring of the health and beauty of the planet diminishes our own health and the beauty of our own lives as well, inescapably. It tells us as well that the laws of nature make no exception for human beings. The new conception of self, personal and collective, that will be born from the collapse of the present one, will therefore bring with it a very different kind of technology, economy, medicine, and way of life that seek to create beauty and that model themselves on the processes of nature. It is not so much a return to nature as a returning of nature to us, a recovering of nature, a reconnection to nature. Of course, nature has never left us. Everything we are is in some sense natural. It's only because we have convinced ourselves otherwise that life has drifted so far out of balance. Our present efforts to deny death, to conquer death, and to artificially prolong life by mechanical means at any cost only increase our fear of death and reinforce our delusions of separateness. They pretend that nature might excuse human beings from her laws, that we might be exempt from the cycles of birth, death, and decay. And fear of death, in turn, really equates to a fear of life, which is about growth, change, and transformation, a continual dying of the old and birth of the new, season to season and moment to moment. To deny death is to deny life. Think of the godlike ideals to which we aspire, the eternal youth, beauty, leisure, and supernatural power of the Olympian gods. Eternal youth is a kind of eternal death, a stasis more akin to an embalmed Egyptian mummy than a living being. Egyptian embalming, after all, was directed at preserving the eternal life of Pharaoh. To despise the fact of aging is not only to despise life, but to betray a pitiful ignorance of the nature of life. Youth is not a state to be preserved, but a state to be transcended. The regime of control that denies death holds us apart from life, too, by preventing us, for safety's sake, from living it fully, but also by cutting us off from even the possibility of fully living by making another of the world. Control, in essence, is a struggle against the world. Medical interventions triumph over nature when they interrupt and deny the natural process of death, as does house cleaning when it reverses the migration of dirt, which is quite literally the world, into our houses. The perfect mastery of nature embodied in the aforementioned Olympian ideals is life-denying even in its more practical incarnation as the secure, ordered life of the modern adult. Thomas Hanna put it like this, quote, "One of the myths of aging is that we cannot do all the things that we once did. But the actual fact about aging is that we cease to do all the things we once did. As our search for a vocation settles into a fixed job, as our search for a mate settles into marriage, as our many expectations settle into a finite number of fulfillments, as our aspirations settle into steady certitudes, and as our broad range of potential movements settles into a narrow band of habitual movements, we will inevitably find ourselves looking in fewer directions and moving in fewer directions. As the possibilities in our life are sorted through, discarded, and finally edited down to a daily routine of actualities, our living functions become limited and specialized. The accepted personal goal of adulthood is, it seems, to settle down and obtain security, to obtain a fixed pattern of life that allows us to escape from the insecurity of freedom and the incertitude of new aspirations. To the degree that individual human beings are seduced into the accepted belief that personal fulfillment means a settled, secure, and circumscribed mode of life, so to that degree do the functions of one's living body adapt, becoming simpler, more straightforward, and rigid." Close quote. The fully insured, 100% guaranteed life that our social institutions suggest, channeled through the media, the schools, and often our parents, that is mapped out in advance to minimize uncertainty, is no life at all. What's more, despite all our efforts to mitigate its uncertainty, life is fundamentally uncertain and out of control. Everyone senses on some level that our management of life is little more than a pretense by which we delude ourselves into believing in the permanence and stability of that which is neither. In this gigantic game of let's pretend, we feign belief in the normalcy of modern life, but no one really believes in it. Hence, the universal sense of phoniness, emptiness, and void underlying the adult world. Reader, do you ever get the feeling that you are a child playing grown-up? When we act the roles of responsible, right-thinking, civilized adults, we are just pretending. Only we have lost ourselves in the pretense. Take heart. It cannot last forever. All of us will one day experience real life smashing through the seemingly secure structures of our lives and selves. When this happens, people often think, how could this be happening? Or this couldn't be? Or this is something that I thought only happened to other people. But worse than the disintegration of the orderly, stable, permanent-seeming life under control is for it to smoothly proceed until time and youth are exhausted. This is the true calamity, and not only because of the agony of regret at finding in old age that we have not truly lived. From the very beginning, there is the feeling of living a life that someone else has planned out, a life that is not truly our own. My college students sometimes report feeling trapped into living the lives their parents and society at large expect them to live. They are aware of the theoretical possibility of changing their major to something impractical, or of dropping out of school and traveling the world, of taking some time off to find themselves, but they cannot find the audacity to take such a step. My parents would kill me, they say. A very revealing statement for the survival anxiety it encodes. Of course, their parents are powerless to stop them, but by now they have internalized the voice of authority so that what is unacceptable to their parents has become unacceptable to themselves. They are thus fully socialized, fully domesticated, except for a submerged longing, a caged and fenced wildness that can and will explode out in the form of violence, longing denied, whenever self-control lapses or when exceptional outside conditions offer temporary release. Aversion to death and aversion to uncertainty in life arise from the same basic worldview. Indeed, if uncertainty is a demise of the familiar, then death is the greatest uncertainty any of us have faced since we left the womb. Both involve letting go of previously fixed categories by which we define who we are. A new job, a new relationship, a new life. We can adopt stringent safeguards to avert such happenings, clinging desperately to the familiar, life and self, but only at an increasing cost. To maintain any system in a state removed from the wild requires a constant expenditure of effort. In the yoga of eating, I use the metaphor of a parking lot, quote, not just the body, but all natural things, when left undisturbed, move naturally toward beauty and wholeness. If you don't keep repaving it every few years, an ugly parking lot will crack. Grass will come up, and after 100 years or so, you'll probably have a beautiful forest. Your body is the same way. Stop paving it over with artificial ways of being. Stop trying to be other than what you are, and it will move towards its natural state of health and beauty. It happens sooner than you think. Why else is rest so healing? Have you ever noticed how beautiful a sleeping person looks? Close quote. The opposite of control is just to let things go, let nature take its course. In suburbia, we maintain control by applying dandelion killer, mowing lawns, weeding flower beds, and pruning shrubs so that our lawns remain neat and orderly. Cease any of these activities, and the land steadily reverts to its wild state. To maintain the manicured lawn considered beautiful requires effort, which is why a person with an unkempt lawn is considered lazy. A similar effort is required to maintain a clean house by literally keeping the world out. If you want to hold your body away from its natural odor, you must bathe frequently and apply various perfumes and antiperspirants. If you let yourself sleep as late as you want, you miss work. If you don't keep track of time, you cannot meet your scheduled obligations. In none of these areas does a civilized person relinquish control. Culture tells us that to do so would lead to disaster, a rapid unraveling of the fabric of our secure, comfortable modern lives. This belief precisely parallels the thinking around original sin, which necessitates self-control so that our wanton, depraved natures won't wreak havoc on the world and on each other. The world must be kept under control. Modern life, predicated on the ever-increasing control of the world that defines technology, therefore demands an ever-increasing effort to maintain control, increasingly fine scheduling of time, less rest, more multitasking, more reliance on technological assistance such as cell phones and planners to make us more efficient. The successful person has it all under control. She manages her time and juggles her responsibilities. She has it all together. The more powerful the control, the greater the effort required to maintain it. Think of the iron discipline of the anorexic, the incessant hand-washing of the germ-phobic, the daily scrubbing and polishing of the clean freak. As is well known, the anorexic or the clean freak is compensating in a safely controllable area of life for a loss of autonomy somewhere else. We ordinary denizens of civilized society are no different. Underlying our superficial structures of control is the same loss of autonomy, a semi-conscious feeling that our lives are not our own. It is a dread, a foreboding, a sense that the most important thing in life, and indeed life itself, has been betrayed. In the pursuit of security, we have traded the infinite, the limitless possibilities of life for the finite, the predictable and safe. This is the same reduction of life inherent in symbolic culture and domestication, the labeling and numbering of the world, the standardization of the machine, and the reductionist program of the scientific revolution. The end result could be none other than the vigorous application of the technological program to all aspects of existence. The ascent of control is a response to the reduction of self to a separate ego, alone and afraid. Taking many guises, it is a fear of death that motivates the effort to control the world and expand the domain of me and mine. When we begin to view life as other than a zero-sum game where my gain is your loss, then the struggle against the world loses motivation, and instead of trying to control life, we let it in. The logic is quite simple. When the other is not another, then to be good to another is to be good to yourself. Shifting perspective, a corollary is that the world is not fundamentally hostile. The dirt won't hurt you. A child, not yet acculturated, is not afraid to get dirty. To civilize children, to enlist them in the world of control that we live in, it is therefore necessary to disconnect them from the vastness of their total being and make them afraid. What needs to happen to domesticate our inborn wilderness? How has my wholeness been damaged? Maybe if we can answer that, we'll know how to get it back. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein.
Alex was a member of my record label, teenager though he is. He joined every vile records in the indie music biz. His parents didn't like such turns of events, so they called up a couple of thugs. Send him back to Utah, lock him up, and pump him full of drugs. They say he's got problems with authority, yeah, this is what they claim. And their psychiatric analysis has even got a name. Oppositional defiant disorder, I think I got it too. Oppositional defiant disorder. He's sick and so are you. That's the chorus. If you think George Bush is a moron and Tony Blair's a liar, if you fantasize about setting your local Walmart on fire, if you don't like Tom Brokaw and you think he's full of it, if you feel a Rush Limbaugh punching bag might be kind of fun to hit, if bombing other countries makes you feel appalled, you have got a problem, and this is what it's called. Oppositional defiant disorder, I think I got it too. Oppositional defiant disorder, he's sick and so are you. If you think school is boring and your teacher is a fool, if you don't like your congressman and you call him a corporate tool, if you were not standing to sing Save the Queen, if you turned down hamburgers and ate rice and beans, we've got a diagnosis, no matter whether you agree. Just do what the doctors tell you, thank God for psychiatry. Oppositional defiant disorder, I think I got it too. oppositional defiant disorder. He's sick and so are you.
Yes and no. Economics, Darwinian biology, and dualistic religion all agree that the only hope for a livable world is if we all try really hard to be nice. Such a view sees civilization as a fundamental good, for it overlays the bestial inclinations of nature with conditioned behaviors that run counter to nature, counter to its win-at-all-costs, eat-or-be-eaten truths. Since the newborn child is wholly natural, wholly uncultured, education and child-rearing aim to destroy or at least suppress the child's original nature in favor of civilized morals, values, and behavior. Hence the enormous emphasis placed on obedience and discipline. The alternative to trying harder is play, which is spontaneous, improvisational, and easy. Play only begins when we are at ease. If we try to play, we do not play. Fear and anxiety, compulsion and coercion, obedience and discipline are inimical to play. Many childhood activities that today go by the name of play, such as gymnastic classes and Little League, are actually closer to skills development or obedience training. But sad to say, our society begins to deny play at an earlier age than that. Until she learns to crawl, a baby's freedom to play is restricted only by her physical capacities. She plays constantly, exploring different ways of moving her body and making sounds. Few parents try to restrict and instruct a child younger than 8 months old, and there is little reason to ever use the word no. But when she becomes mobile, the baby or toddler can, as all we parents know, get into trouble, make messes, refuse to cooperate, and even endanger herself. Maybe she wants to take out all the pots and pans and bang on them for half an hour. Maybe she doesn't want to get into her car seat. Maybe she isn't hungry right now and would rather throw her food onto the floor. Maybe she wants to climb up the slide backwards. What if some other child hits her on the way down? She could fall and hurt herself. Situations like these elicit that defining word of early childhood, no, which acquires its force from the violence, physical or verbal, that accompanies it, or the implicit threat of such violence. In each case, we feel the necessity of asserting control. We cannot let her bang away on the pots and pans because of the horrible racket and the mess. Plus, it is just so disorderly. She has to get into her car seat right now because we have to be somewhere at 10 o'clock, and it is unsafe and illegal not to ride in a child restraint device, as I like to call it. Matthew, get into your child restraint device. Throwing her food on the floor makes such a mess. And besides, dinner time is now, not later, and we have other things to do. Immersed in modern life, we are at the mercy of its schedules. We are busy. As for the playground slide, well, maybe if we think about it rationally, it isn't so dangerous, but we must teach her to respect rules, after all. On one level, we seek to corral our children's autonomy and creativity for the same reasons we corral our own. It isn't practical, realistic, or safe. Subtly, or not so subtly, we try to steer them toward practicality, safety, good manners, and good morals. Today, crude methods employing outright fear of physical pain have fallen out of favor. Instead, we manipulate our children through selective praise and disapproval. We contrive to make them feel good about doing what we approve of, and guilty or ashamed about doing what we disapprove of. Sometimes a mere inflection of the voice is enough, or a subtle comparison to a sibling or friend. The program of control is both subtle and pervasive. It is nearly always unconscious. If you are a parent, listen to yourself as you speak to your children. Notice when, through word or tone, you create a subtext of "you are bad" or "you are conditionally good." If you have parents, Listen for that in their communication to you. And finally, no matter who you are, listen for it in your communications with yourself. I have found it pervades my inner dialogue. I am good because of this, bad because of that. I can't do X because I'd be bad if I did. I must do Y or I won't be good. You won't necessarily use the actual words bad or good. Instead, you might employ substitutes like lazy, indulgent, selfish, greedy, or wrong for the former, and cool, nice, deserving, worthy, or right for the latter. Underneath these words, feelings of guilt, self-rejection, desire for approval, anxiety, and shame shepherd us through a life under control. The sophistication of this program becomes apparent when we realize that many of the child's behaviors that we seek to control are not actually that dangerous. The justification, "we must teach her to respect rules," takes us to the root of the issue. Overriding the immediate concerns of safety and convenience is the principle that she must learn to obey her parents. She must submit to discipline, at first external, then internalized as an adult. Control is actually a goal more important than safety, practicality, and morality that justifies it. Consider the two cardinal sins of childhood, disobedience and lying. More than nearly any other infraction, disobedience and lying are profoundly disturbing to the typical parent. They provoke irrational and often unbearable frustration, helplessness, and rage because they reveal that the child is out of control. They amount to an assertion, inaction, of the child's autonomy. As such, they are sure to incite the harshest punishment. I remember one time years ago, my son Jimmy was riding his trike around our cul-de-sac when I saw a car pulling out of a driveway. "Jimmy," I shouted, "a car wants to pull out. Move to the side of the road." When he didn't respond, I shouted again, a little louder, "Jimmy, get out of the way. There's a car coming." Still, he didn't respond. Fortunately, the driver had seen him and driven around him and out of the cul-de-sac. He had never actually been in much danger. But by then, I'd completely lost my temper. I walked up to him and screamed in his face about how he must always do as his father says, because what if the car didn't see him? Jimmy, of course, began crying, and it was quite a while before I, feeling miserably guilty the whole time, could console him. After years of reflection on this and similar incidents, I eventually realized that the danger of the car was just an excuse. The real reason I lost it was because I felt threatened. I wanted to frighten him into submission. I was furious that he didn't do as I said, and I wanted to scare him into obeying me next time. I was also embarrassed because the neighbor probably disapproved of my lax supervision of his activities. I felt like a bad parent. Jimmy's disobedience triggered a deep unease that actually had little to do with any real danger. I have since learned that to gain a child's trust and obedience, it is far more effective to kneel down in front of him, take his hands, look at him at eye level, and sincerely tell him, in calm but certain words, why it is important to listen to his father. It is so much more effective to trust that a child naturally desires guidance and protection of the parent, and to speak to that desire. It is not necessary to subdue his spirit. It is not necessary to fight human nature. Can you believe that? Can you believe that my children almost always obey me, and I never threaten or punish them? We don't live in a Newtonian world where only force could change the course of matter. And can you see that my children rarely have any cause to lie to me? There is nothing to evade. Think back on your own adolescence. Did you routinely deceive your parents in order to gain freedom and avoid punishment? Did you have a secret life? How long, if ever, did it take to restore intimacy and trust? Our alienation from our children is yet another example of how control isolates us from the world. The fashionable locution, "you need to," is a telling manifestation of the domination of children's spirits. I heard one mother, after her 6-year-old daughter had ignored 2 or 3 requests to go inside and get ready for bed, switch to a tone of angry, insistent menace. "Maggie, you need to go inside right now." As George Orwell observed, to dominate a person's actions is not enough. His thoughts and feelings must be under control as well. I am not blaming the mother, for she is just a channel for the climate of the culture. But think of the tyranny of dictating to someone what they need. Any marriage counselor will tell you that it is disrespectful and unproductive to tell another person how they should be feeling. But we do it to children all the time through praise and disapproval, reward, threat, and shame. The subtle forms of control I have described seem gentler than the whippings and beatings of yesteryear, but in essence they are no different. They are merely a different means to access a child's greatest fear. Far more than pain, what a child or any young mammal fears most is rejection or abandonment by the parent. That is why children have been known to willingly kiss the hand that strikes them, or even ask for punishment. From this perspective, a put-down is the same as a beating. Both invoke the primal fear of abandonment. In fact, an occasional spanking is probably less damaging than a prolonged campaign of control that makes a child feel never good enough for complete acceptance. Never good enough. When approval is conditional on performance, then no degree of perfection can ever suffice to put the child at ease. The same is true when he grows up and internalizes parental approval as self-approval. Conditional approval means you are perpetually on probation. Your natural self is bad, so you have to try hard to be good. Yet no amount of effort can build a tower to heaven. No matter what heights we achieve, we always fall infinitely short. The human spirit is so strong that only a threat to survival can subdue it. The primal fear of abandonment is instrumental in breaking a child's spirit. The training or acculturation of children taps into survival anxiety at the deepest level. Remember my students who say, "My parents would kill me"? That is a code phrase for fear of abandonment. Survival anxiety is also what motivates the parents. We typically rationalize this breaking of a child's spirit by saying it is for his own good, either in terms of physical safety or in terms of winning a secure place in society. What would happen, after all, if we raised a child to do what he wants to do instead of what he has to do? A child who always puts play before work. A child who never compromised his dignity. Such a child could not occupy the usual roles society offers, would never submit to the humiliating routines of school, nor the routine humiliation of life in the machine. Derek Jensen puts it this way, quote, "I've since come to understand the reason school lasts 13 years. It takes that long to sufficiently break a child's will. It is not easy to disconnect children's wills, to disconnect them from their own experience of the world in preparation for the lives of painful employment they will have to endure. Less time wouldn't do it, and in fact, those who are especially slow go to college. For the exceedingly obstinate child, there is graduate school." Close quote. The tyranny is far more subtle than Jensen describes, because it is actually not those children whose will is especially strong who go on to college and graduate school for some additional will-breaking. Quite the opposite. College and graduate school are a kind of reward allowed only to those who, through good grades, have demonstrated that their wills are sufficiently broken to qualify for elite positions in society. Certainly there are a lucky few who simply love schoolwork, but for most, school is a chore, a discipline through which we demonstrate our willingness to do as we are told. Those who cannot bring themselves to fully comply with the instructions, whose attention wanders, who clown around in class, who would rather play outside than do homework, whose aversion fuels a spirit strong enough to resist the institutional, cultural, and parental mechanisms that enforce compliance, will not get good grades in school. Instead, they will earn labels such as stupid, lazy, bad, or increasingly medicalized versions of these, such as ADD, attention deficit disorder, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or my favorite, ODD, oppositional defiant disorder. Then, where the veiled threats, phony incentives, and other forms of scholastic manipulation have failed, we can resort to pharmaceutical methods of control to rein in the recalcitrant child. Society will do just about anything it takes to compel the child to take no for an answer. This is a vast undertaking, because it is anathema to the human spirit of exploration and creativity. That is why we see toddlers repeating the word to themselves over and over, trying to come to grips with it, trying to reconcile its life-denying force with the creative potency within them. Try this sometime. Go to one of those little playgrounds for young children, the ones full of young mothers with their toddlers. Close your eyes and listen. One word will stick out like a sore thumb. Again and again you'll hear it, pronounced in menacing tones. No, Jeremy. No, Ashley. No, Courtney. No, no, no. Think of the impact on a small child. The parents are gods in his eyes. Enormous, omnipotent figures, nearly coextensive, especially in the young toddler with the universe itself. The gods tell us no, with menace and threat of alienation. The universe is not friendly. We are not free. Internalized at a young age, the relentless refrain of no echoes throughout our childhood and adolescence until, by the time we reach maturity, it has silently imbued itself into our fundamental perceptions. The result is that we come to doubt the validity of our own creativity. We are constantly looking over our shoulders and wondering if it's okay, wondering if it's acceptable to venture into new territory. And eventually, we become accustomed to this state of being, comfortable with a world in which everything is either expressly permitted or explicitly forbidden, where there is no uncertainty, no ambiguity, no open territory. Our entire lives, in other words, have become defined by this innocent-looking two-letter word. That, I imagine, was the intuition underneath the radical 60s message. The establishment says no, the yippies say yes. Yes to what? The declaration needs no explanation because its meaning is intuitively obvious. A universal yes that needs no object. In bogus compensation for cutting us off for most of life with the word no, society offers us limited, harmless, and ultimately phony areas for escapism and indulgence, where we can enjoy a narrow range of trivial freedoms. The model for this is the playpen, a highly circumscribed section of the world where every variable is under control, where we can't knock over a lamp, dirty the carpet, or run amok, where it is absolutely safe. The exuberance and abandon of real living happens in safe, controlled fragments of life, on vacations, in bars, at parties, at amusement parks, on guided tours, through shopping catalogs, channel surfing, the internet, and the limitless universe of consumer brands. These are the playpens of adulthood. Within these playpens, our society seeks now to encompass the whole of life. Here we find the counterpart of no, a conditional, narrow yes, defined by our own fears and by the prohibitions of society. Above, I wrote that the world of play still survives intact through the first 8 months of life. But just now I glanced at a news article about the latest trends in baby workouts, where the class uses music and props to keep the babies focused and helps improve their eye tracking and coordination. In the hands of a good teacher, such a class could be wholly playful. But the very concept reveals the general migration of physical movement, originally one of the greatest joys of being alive, into the realm of work. Exercise or a workout, something we have to do for fitness, to control our weight or shape the body. Here is yet another extension of the scheduled, directed, programmed life into unprecedented territory. Play's end, as Joseph Chilton Pierce sorrowfully puts it, comes at a very early age these days. It has to. The spirit must be broken early to submit to a world under control. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. And continuing in Chapter 5 of The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein, The World Under Control. The next section, The Pressure to Break Free. When we clamp down and control life, we generate a pressure that must find an outlet. The release is usually guilty and often in secret, and directs our creative life force, our divine nature, into activities that are generally trivial, meaningless, marginal to our main occupation, and sometimes downright destructive. To most of the roles society offers, I say, you are made for more than that. We inhabit, in the words of Ivan Illich, a world in which nobody fits that has not been crushed and molded by 16 years of formal education. The very idea of having to be at a job on time was appalling to early industrial laborers, who also refused the numbing repetitiveness of industrial work until the specter of starvation compelled them. What truly self-respecting person would spend a life marketing soda pop or chewing gum unless they were somehow broken by repeated threats to survival? To participate in our society's depredations is an indignity. A corporate executive recently confessed to me that his job consisted of lying to the customer. Another, that his job consisted of frightening customers into accepting digital security products that they didn't really need. An elite lawyer described his job as, "I take money from one rich son of a bitch and give it to another rich son of a bitch. Part of my job at Penn State is to pass judgment on students by issuing them a grade. To be sure, there are many people fortunate enough," 321. "To be sure, there are many people fortunate enough to have interesting jobs, creative jobs, perhaps even meaningful jobs. But even if you love your work, what do you have to put up with in order to do it? Indignity is hard to avoid when our whole economy revolves around the creation and fulfillment of phony needs. It is hard to avoid when our institutions depend on standardization of roles. It is hard to avoid when profitability and even survival of a company conflicts with human and community values. We all know this, yet we feel compelled to participate. To participate in any form of injustice, humiliation, or degradation of people or the environment is in itself degrading. What does it take to get a divine human spirit to participate in this? It requires its breaking so that we dare not say no. To cut corners, to do something just well enough for the grade, the customer, or the boss. To do anything with the feeling that it doesn't really matter. To care about your work mostly because you are paid to care about it. All of this is degrading. It is an indignity to make anything less than an art out of your work. That is what we are made for, nothing less." I will never forget the day long ago when I realized that I didn't really care about anything I did at my job. We were having a meeting about some new computer audio capability, and everyone seemed quite interested in it. A lively discussion was going on about how to integrate it into our software. I looked around the room and thought, "Hold on, you mean you people really care about this? I thought we were all just pretending to care." At that moment, I realized I only cared about it because I was paid to care, a realization which fueled a growing sense of panic in the weeks to come. There's got to be more than this, I thought. What about caring about something for real? What about devoting my full energy to work that I love? Don't I get to have that this lifetime? Very few of society's usual positions can accommodate the enormous creative life force of an unbroken human being. To keep the world under control demands that we bottle up this creative force and expend as much of it as possible in harmless ways. Harmless to the status quo, that is, though not to the individual. All the addicts and alcoholics I have known, all of them, are blessed or cursed with what seems to be an exceptional creative energy that is burned up in their addiction. Other people channel it into obsessions and compulsions, hobbies, nervous tics, excessive exercise, overeating, work, and the like, contributing to a more dilute version of the addict's sense of life betrayed. When we submit to lesser lives, we cannot avoid a sense of self-betrayal, that we are complicit in the plunder of our most precious possession. The roles society offers do not befit the divine beings we are. It is not merely that a career as a retail clerk is beneath my dignity, it is beneath anyone's dignity. No one is meant to do such work for very long. It can be fun for a while, for a few days or weeks it takes to fully master it and learn what there is to learn. One of the best jobs I ever had was washing dishes in the university cafeteria. It was fun figuring out the series of hand movements that maximized my efficiency, learning how the kitchen worked, having food fights with the other dishwashers, and spraying my friends with the dishwashing hose when they came to bust their trays. Everyone should do jobs like this for a while, as I did, a couple of hours a day, a few days a week. It is only when, through poverty and despair, we become enslaved to such work that it becomes degrading. When a divine spirit mortgages her very purpose in life, which is joyful participation in the creation of a beautiful universe, she will compensate by being good to herself in whatever ways are available. She may thus appear selfish or greedy, but all she is really doing is searching for something that is missing. Of course, no amount of food, material possessions, physical beauty, power over other people, or money can fulfill her need as a divine being to express her creative potential and experience intimate connection to the rest of life. Here is the wound of separation in two forms: separation from the divine creative nature of the self, and separation from other people and nature. The sense of entitlement that drives selfishness and greed thus arises from an authentic source, that we have been robbed of our birthright. Something is missing. It's just that we are looking in the wrong place for it. An ancient Sufi tale describes the sage fool, Mullah Nasruddin, groping around under the streetlight. A passerby asks, "Mullah, what are you looking for?" "Alas," replies the hapless Nasruddin, "I have lost my house key." "Well, when was the last time you saw it?" "I think I lost it over there in the shadow of those trees." "Well, why are you looking for it here then?" "Sir, can you not see how dark it is there? I am looking here under the streetlight where I can see better."